morning. I was in the auditorium, and I was looking at very hollow faces that I've never seen before. And especially when I put on the first slide, they were like, okay. But the difference is a little bit less striking here, but still I feel a little bit like a foreigner here, because I'm the experimentalist and I'm trying to tell you a little bit about an experiment which I think has nice theoretical implications and may invite to new theoretical work. And so I will try to present what we have been doing and what we are doing in Heidelberg at a very moderate level, so that also non-experimentalists may be able to get the fine features of what we're doing and still be in phase with the large picture. And what I would like to reach is that during this talk, I get to transmit a feeling for what we are sensitive to, what we can do, and then invite for the lunch discussion which follows, discussions on how to proceed, where we may have overlap, and where we may want to get things done during our stays here at the Tavli Institute. So I'll just throw you into the deep water and start with describing the experiment. A very simple experiment. And that's why the first picture is a picture of the experiment. And I will try to do that briefly. The experiment that I will be talking about is called atomic beam spin echo, and you will see why in a second. And then I'll talk a little bit about our bread and butter experiments that we started out with when we developed the method. And then that brought us actually to more interesting subjects, which is one of the reasons why I'm here, namely looking at fluctuation-induced forces, especially the Casimir polar force, and various aspects of it. The reason why we can, in fact, measure these feeble forces is because we use an additional effect in the spin echo machine, quantum reflection, and then having put all the ingredients together, I will show you where we may do sensitive tests to QED predictions and even go beyond the standard model and try to test for some actual problems in physics. And then I'll show you our current status, what we think we understand, and what we know we don't, and where we need to do some work, and that will be in the final session of the talk. Okay, now this is the experiment. There's a particle flying from the left to the right. It's a free atom which has a nuclear momentum. And if you apply a magnetic field and along the axis, then the original spin starts to process around the z axis. And when you afterwards apply another magnetic field in the opposite direction, it processes back again. Now, that is the whole idea behind the experiment. You take a particle with an internal structure, you make it process, and the number of processions it makes is actually only proportional to the time it spends in this first magnetic field, and the magnetic moment of the particle, of course, and the strength of the magnetic field, but that's all trivial. Then if you apply the second field of opposite direction and nothing has changed in between, then the particle spends just as much time in the first coil as it does in the second coil, so it spins up, but it unwinds in the second coil just as much. So when you start off with a beam of particles that are polarized in one direction, after all the gymnastics, they come back out polarized again. And that is where the echo occurs. Now, since we don't use a monochromatic beam, we have a beam of particles with all kind of velocities, there is a spread as soon as they start to spin. And you see that in the overall polarization along the beam axis. So you start with full polarization, and then they do one revolution, but they slightly out of phase. They dephase even more and more, and so the overall magnetization along the beam axis disappears. And in the middle, if you would measure the polarization, there would be nothing left. But then, by applying the opposite magnetic field, you basically invert the time dynamics, and the whole thing shuffles up again to a coherent overlap of spins. And so what you see is an echo appearing out of the nothing. It's an atomic beam, and the spins are being echoed. That explains the title of the technique. Now, that's it. You can say, well, I haven't gained much. But now you could think of doing an experiment between the two coils. And suppose in this experiment, you make the particles lose or gain a little bit of energy. Suppose they lose a little bit of energy. And the only thing they can lose is kinetic energy. Then they come in, they spin up, then they do their thing, lose a little bit of energy, and get slower. So they enter the second coil with a less velocity, so they spend much more time in the second coil. So they'll rewind too much. And as it turns out, that the angle of rotation that they did too much is proportional to the energy that you lost in the middle. So by encoding the velocities onto the spin degree of freedom, you get a very sensitive measure of energy loss and gain process in single atomic processes. That is the basic. I don't know why this movie is stuttering the way it is. Okay, this is the same thing that I said in words, now in a picture, and I never liked it, so I'll just skip it. This is then what you see. If you have no magnetic field supplied, these are actual data. You get a full polarization beam, and it does one rotation, two rotations, three rotations, and due to the dispersion of the beam, the overall magnetic moment falls off. You can also do minus one rotation, minus two, minus three. Now, if you apply magnetic fields in both coils, you can do, for example, 4,000 revolutions in the first coil and 4,000 backwards in the second. So that's here. Or you can do 4,001 revolutions. Actually, this is 3,999 revolutions backwards, 3,998, etc., or 4,001, 4,002, 4,003. The overall maximum of this echo tells you, basically that's a spin echo point, that's where you exactly have the two magnetic fields equal. And so if you can count the number of rotations that they act. And mind remind you that the spacing between two full rotations is only 150 nano electron volt. Yeah, so a tenth of a micro electron. These are experimental data. Well, how were they acquired? Well, in this machine. And since it's mainly public of theoreticians, I only mark the big blobs in the experiment. We need a beam. Unfortunately, this picture is from the right to the left. So here we create a beam of particles. In this case, we take the simplest particle of all, which has a nice handle on its magnetic moment. We take helium, it's very inert, it's a noble gas, and it has a nuclear spin, so it's well protected by the electron cloud. So you have this internal clock, basically, in this noble gas atom, with which you now can do each kind of experiment. Since it's a nuclear magnetic moment, it's very small, and so in order to polarize that beam, you need large magnetic field gradients, and what we do is just Stern-Gerlach in a quadrupole magnet. So we have this beam, which actually has to be cooled down in order to get it polarized down to 1 Kelvin. So it's a cold beam. And detecting we do simply by ionizing and counting them in a mass spectrometer. So nothing particularly about that. Then in the middle, we do the scattering, and we want to have full control over that, and I'll get to that in a second. Then I told you we want to make them spin, so we need two spin echo coils, the first one in which it winds up, the second one in which the precession is undone. And since they have to be polarized, and at the end, it has to be analyzed, we have this two Stern Gay-Lussac magnets. One is a quadrupole at the beginning to polarize, and one is a hexapole at the ending to analyze the magnetic moments. So these are the ingredients, but what looks so nice on paper in practice looks like this. And it's like a badly written spaghetti program. Well, it grew along the way, as you can imagine. To identify a couple of things, here is the source, and you see this tubing here, which is not the vacuum tubing, it's actually a mu metal shielding in order to get rid of all stray magnetic fields. This is the scattering center. Here and here, you have the spin echo coil one, and here the second spin echo coil, and this is the detector. Mind you that you can rotate the entire machine along around this vertical axis, so you can have full control over the kinematic parameters within the scattering experiment. Just to open up the mu metal, you can see along the light tube, this is actually the vacuum tubing. This is the first spin echo coil, and this is the second spin echo coil. Why they look like that has experimental reasons. This is the most robust way of manipulating spins. So, now we had this thing set up within about 1 year. And we were thinking, well, what kind of experiment could you do to show that this is actually a good experiment? This has potential. And we couldn't figure out anything. And we had as a benchmark the best developed time of flight machines available on the world market those days had a resolution of 0.1 millielectron volt, 10 to the minus 4 electron volt. And we thought we could do better than that, but we couldn't think of any experiment which was easy just to run. Until one day we walked up to the institute, which is on top of a mountain, and like every morning, we arrived thinking, God, this mountain actually is tiring. And then we transposed the idea of having to go uphill from ourselves to the atoms, and we had the machine do the same thing. So we lifted up the detector about 1 meter, and we had the atoms fly uphill. And the two measuring points are the two spin echo coils. And the height difference between the center of these two coils was 11 centimeters. And since we have helium with mass 3, because it has a nuclear moment, so it's a helium-3 isotope, the mass is known, the height difference is known, G is pretty well known. And so you can calculate M times G times delta H. That will give you 33 nanoelectron volt energy loss. And within no time, in one first run, we could measure that with a statistical error of 1 nanoelectron volt. So here we are with this new method, having a statistical limitation resolution of 1 nanoelectron volt with respect to 0.1 millielectron volt of the best time of flight machine available those days. So about 4 or 5 orders of magnitude at our disposal to start looking at things that you couldn't be looking at before. So, before we do that, though, it will become of importance to rerun the experiment by you again, but now not in a semi-classical picture, but in the full quantum picture, because then it becomes much more transparent what we are doing when we do actual surface experiments or Casimir Polet. So remember that I said I have this beam polarized and I bring it into a magnetic field and starts to process. Well, that's the semi-classical vectorial picture. What you actually want to say is that I have a wave packet which is spin polarized, and this spin eigenstate is no eigenstate of the new magnetic coordination axis that I have here. And so what happens is this state is split into the coherent sum of two new eigenstates, one with a magnetization parallel, one anti-parallel, to the applied magnetic field, and they are circularly polarized. So this state is now decomposed in a coherent sum of right-handed and left-handed, which actually in this field have different energies. Different energies means different kinetic energy in this case. So what happens is that you have this one wave packet, it enters the coil, and then it is split up in two circular components which have different velocity. And so they run apart. Now, after the first coil, they have been separated by a certain spatial distance, which if you translate it by their speed, their mean speed, it means that they have a time of arrival difference in between the two coils. Now, when you apply the second magnetic field, the right-handed now becomes the left-handed becomes the right-handed, so the slow one becomes fast, and the fast one becomes slow, and so what happens in the second coil, they run back together again, and the two partial wave packets start overlapping and interfering like the fingers of my hand. And what you see is an interference of one atom wave packet with itself at the end. And this atom interferometry, this interference pattern that you saw, that you get, is exactly what I showed you at the beginning in the data, one oscillation, two oscillations, three oscillations, etc. That is just an interferometry pattern. Okay, so that's the quantum mechanical picture. And just to make 1,000 words compressed in one picture, this is what happens. I have to restart this again. You start off with a polarized wave packet in the x direction, which in this z magnetic field is going to be split up in two components, a blue and a green one, which have different speeds, and so they run apart. When you invert the magnetic field, they run back together again, and where they start overlapping, you'll have this red interference pattern. So what you measure here is the interference pattern of one atom wave packet. Now, you can get all kinds of information out of scattering processes that occur in the middle. For example, if you have a quasi-elastic process which reduces the second wave packet, then at the point of interference, you see that the contrast of this pattern reduces. So in the contrast of your interference pattern, there's the information on the quasi-elasticity of the processes. Or if you do something inelastic, like in this picture, here we're pulling them apart, then we do something inelastic in the middle. Actually, we're kicking the green one in the butt, so it becomes faster. So it speeds up, and it reaches the blue one earlier, so the interference pattern moves forward. So the location and the contrast of this interference pattern contains all the information on the scattering process. In fact, you can write it out. What you get is the intermediate scattering function. It's the Fourier transform of the normal scattering function, which everybody knows as the S-matrix. So it contains all the physics, this thing here. Then if it contains all the physics, what can you do with it? And since I said, well, I haven't mentioned that, but we have a surface science background, we started off looking at surface science processes as our bread and butter. And just to give you a flavor, I'll start off with things like this, a little bit of inelasticity. So we're looking at phonons or diffusion, very slow motions, which are very appropriate to this time scale or the energy scale that we are sensitive. These are long time scales on a scattering frame of reference. So the frame of reference would be like the scattering process takes a picosecond, and we're sensitive to up to a microsecond process. So a microsecond means that is the time that I can split up this one wave packet in two partial waves and get it back together. So we started off with thing we thought was something very simple. We start off with gold, a noble metal, 111s, it's a fully filled surface, so it's very flat, and we thought this is like ice. And it's like extremely nice and structureless. Well, wrong we were. Actually, it turns out that gold is the only noble metal, that doesn't like to be cleaved. It doesn't like just to be cut and have vacuum on the one side and bulk on the other. And what it does, it takes one extra atom and pulls it into the surface. But because there's not enough room, that actually buckles up the surface. That's supposed to buckle up the surface. No? Where is it? There it is. So by pulling in this one extra atom, you get a camelback structure, which has an extremely long wavelength, but a very, very small amplitude. This has been, the scale here has been exaggerated by a factor of 1,000. The height of this camelback is only 0.2 angstrom, 2 to the minus 11 meters. So it looks flat in first principle, but in fact it isn't. And if you have a machine that's sensitive, then you can actually use the Bragg condition and your energy resolution to get very high spatial resolution. The Bragg condition enters, in the Bragg condition enters the wavelength, and by measuring the wavelength very accurately, you can have a very accurate number on the Bragg condition. So that's what we did. This is what you see. If you just scatter the helium atoms off of the gold surface, you get one very large peak. But if you magnify the wings of this peak, you can see that there's structure in there, which is due to the fact that there's this camelback amplitude. And by just sitting on, by just looking at this spectrum, you said, okay, well, this is not very well resolved. This is like the third order Bragg, second order Bragg, first order Bragg, etc. But these are very wide. Where's your resolution? Well, what you do, if you set your detector on one angle, like I said, you can rotate the detector, have full kinematic control, and then you do spin echo to measure which wavelength actually contributes to exactly this diffraction angle. And then you get the full resolution that you had in the spin echo setup. And with that, you can actually resolve that this this camelback structure is not a static one, but it actually has a dispersion curve. And what you can do, you measure it as a function of k, the energy of that mode, and I'll show you here on the dispersion curve the range that we are sensitive to. Of course, that's not a large range. That is just a few milli. That's 1 milli electron volt. And this is the k range, the wave vector that we are sensitive to. And I enlarge this region, and I'll show you the data.
Could you just go back to
three pictures back? Okay. Is this three? Which one? Okay.
So the idea is, the way you said it, one guy pushes his way in and creates kind of a buckle, I guess, if it's a
camelback, yeah.
Camelback. Okay. Mm-hmm. But this camel, now he's got a lot of humps, so he's just right here, and then there's going to be another camel.
No, it's actually well structured. It's It forms a hexagonal face.
There you go.
And it's well ordered, and it's over very long coherence length.
You wouldn't have got those.
We wouldn't have got it. No. Yeah. As it turns out, it forms like a how do you call that? A fishbone, herringbone structure of patches, which are about 200 nanometer large, 200 times 200 nanometer.
Right. So we're not supposed to be worrying about what's underneath that compression.
You could, but I'm not.
But we are supposed to say that they know how far apart they are, obviously, if you didn't get nice pictures, by some kind of a stressing laterally, just because there's an extra benefit of sticking your nose.
Yeah. Actually, if you look at it from the top,
yeah.
You would see that normally you would have like the HCP structure.
Okay.
And then after this first hump, it goes to a FCC. And back to an HCP. So it makes also a lateral move, just to move over to the FCC spot of the third layer.
Wow. So we really should be thinking as the picture tells, it's over the whole scene.
Yeah, it's over the whole.
And locally, the symmetry seems to change just to take convex and concave into it.
Yes.
and what happens underneath is sort of adjusted.
Actually, it actually extends into the third layer, they say. It has to be, because, I mean, SCC and HCP, it decides upon the third layer. The energetics of it is not high. And in fact, what I've shown you here, the dispersion curve, actually was calculated in the 80s by Chris. And he calculated this for all kind of metals, for platinum and so on. And he was very convinced that he did the right thing. Only for gold he never published, because he had this dispersion curve. This is zero energy, which in his calculation became imaginary. And he couldn't believe his result. And he said, OK, I must have numerical instability. I'll keep it to myself. How right he was. Because when we started measuring here, that's in fact what happened. This Rayleigh mode hits this axis right at the wave vector, which determines the spacing of the Camelback structure. So the periodicity of this Camelback is exactly where this point becomes imaginary. So with the phonon modes, this very soft phonon freezes out and becomes stationary. Yeah, and that is basically shown in these data. This is the normal dispersion. And here's this one low-lying Rayleigh mode, which hits the energy axis at zero at exactly the wave vector where the Camelback structure has its periodicity. So the whole picture is consistent. And in fact, Kress was very happy to see that he had numerical correct results. OK. By the way, this is a very lively bath. This is very low energy mode. So at room temperature, this is very, very wild. And you can change the temperature of the surface and measure the same thing again and then get the activation energy of these modes. And what you also can do is put something on top and make the whole phonon bath silent. That's what we did. We put this kind of beast on there. This is even further away from theory. This is like a pancake. We wanted this thing because it has a large area. It mines down. It doesn't evaporate. And it can move freely. What we actually were thinking, we wanted to have a puck on ice. Ice hockey is a very popular sport here. So we figured, let's measure that at the nanoscale. This is about 10 angstrom in diameter. It is a six ring with six rings around it. And it's a conjugated system. It's flat like a pancake, binds very, very well to the surface. Actually, the first thing that happens is when you put it down, just a few of them, every 100, 200 angstrom, the whole phonon bath becomes silent. Because now you have these scattering centers from which the phonon, these long wave phonons, start building standing waves. And the standing waves have no dispersion. And so in the dispersion curve, it's gone. This anomalous mode is then all of a sudden gone, with just a few of these thumbnails onto the surface. But then we wanted to look at ice hockey phenomena. And it turns out, well, you have to reconsider ice hockey. Actually, normally, if you look at a movie, you get a number of pictures. And the number of pictures is exactly the same thing as a spin echo. When I told you, well, in the quantum mechanical picture, you have this one wave packet that becomes before the other. That actually gives you two pictures, because the first wave packet comes and it scatters from the surface. And it takes all the scattering information in its S matrix and flies to the second coil. So here's my surface that is, I don't know, about a micron times a micron. All you see is the unit cells of the gold, and now I put this coronane molecules, these big pancakes, on there. And they are distributed like this. Now the first packet comes, scattered from this area, carries all the information with it to the second corner. Then the second one comes, and it sees this distribution on the right-hand side. And it carries the scattering information with it to the second coil. And then what happens? I bring them back together, and I make them interfere. Now, making them interfere is like comparing the two pictures one to one. If I would ask you, did anything happen between the arrival time of the first packet and the second packet? then you'd be hard-pressed to tell me, yes, it did. But if I compare the two, if I just overlay the two, then I immediately see that there's a difference in this atomic position. So what I can tell from the interference pattern is that one molecule has actually moved two lattice positions to the left. So it's a number of time frames that you see and that you can use to measure the dynamics at surfaces. And the one thing of dynamics that we looked at was jump diffusion, just to get you a feel of what we're doing. So here's this camelback structure again, exaggerated in the y direction. And here's this big molecule sitting on there. And if you look at the dynamics of this molecule with a spin echo method, like looking at it in time frames, then what you'll see is that it doesn't move freely. What it does, it jumps. And it jumps exactly 20 angstrom. It jumps from this top to this top, which at first sight would not be the preferable site, but obviously energetically that is the preferable site. It only does this jump, these lengths, and by varying the temperature, you can get the activation energy, you get the amount of trials before it jumps, you get the jump frequency, etc. You get all the information at an atomic level. But that's the jump in this direction. Now you can change the rotation of the machine and the kinematic parameters and look along these channels here, what happens. And then it turns out that there is a barrier-free, there's a barrier-free motion along the channels. And now I exaggerated the y direction only a factor of 10, so it's 100 times less. Actually, it's 10 times less. It's a factor of 100. And then you see that these large molecules almost move freely along the channels. So if you look in one direction, so you see free diffusion. If you look at the other direction, you see jump diffusion. Yes? Yeah, we change the temperature to get the activation energy. So this is anything between 100 Kelvin and 600 Kelvin. That's where we measured. That's why we wanted these pancakes, that they even at 600 Kelvin stick to the surface. So you have a good temperature range to get a Arrhenius plot from the activation energy. Excuse me, and the reconstruction temperature, which is below at room temperature, it is reconstructed. But to initiate it, so if you cleave it at room temperature, it's not at equilibrium. You have to heat it up to, I think, about 800 degrees to get it relaxed, and then cool it slowly down, and then it's in equilibrium. But then it is reconstructed. So, back to this picture of things that we have been looking at and we are looking at, just in order to give you guys maybe a hint or an idea or a thing for discussion later on, we've looked at Brownian motion, 3D motion of simple atoms, because just by the same fact that I said you have this time delay between two wave packets that come, you can have a gas sitting there, and there sits one molecule, and when the first package comes, the molecule sits there, but when the second comes, it is gone. Then by changing the time delay between the two packets, you have a feel for the Brownian motion. And in fact, what we did, we measured for all the noble gases, really the Brownian, it's a very expensive thermometer, if you wish. But actually, we measured the temperature, the normal Brownian motion of all the noble gases. And it turns out that if you go to very small times, you see the long-range interaction tail. So you see that it's no hard balls that are just there or not there. You see that it's a little bit there, and you see the attractive part of the potential coming in. But OK, that's one thing. The other thing is for people interested in soft matter, what we have been looking at is very soft membrane-like structures. You can, I mean, maybe you know that you have these self-assembled monolayers. These are membrane, the fatty acids. which are very long-tailed, which are functionalized with sulfur, so they stick to the surface well in a well-defined way, and then they have this motion like cornfields, the collective motion, very soft modes. And we've been looking at these kind of things, tiles they call, on gold and on silicon. And what we wanted to be looking at, and we have not finalized, and we'll get back to that, looking at phase transitions of two phases of surfaces, so basically at surface melting, and checking the correlation times close to the critical point. Now, this is a two-dimensional system, so it's a system that you can deal with theoretically well, and then we would like to see whether we get the critical exponents right and things like that. So that is another issue that we are working on. But then, since we were that sensitive to anything happening to the surface, we actually, at a certain point, started asking ourselves, well, what is it we're doing? Normally, surface scientists ask themselves, well, how clean is my surface? How well did I prepare it, etc. This is single crystal. This is absolutely clean. We'll clean it up. If there's any dirt on it, if there's any roughness in it, we can quantify it just by normal diffraction of the helium atom. So we have full control over the system. And so we know it is clean. And we know how good my vacuum was and how good I prepared it. And we started thinking, well, why don't we turn the question around? Let's no longer ask what the vacuum does to my surface. But let me ask the question, what does the surface do to the vacuum? And that brings us then to the fluctuation-induced things, like the quantum electrodynamical description of the vacuum, and to the Casimir Pulder forces. Anything better than 10 to the minus 10? If it's critical, 10 to the minus 11 at the detector of 10 to the minus 13, so that's quite good. And that is also, that is the burden. I mean, in order to do clean surface experiments, you have to have very clean vacuum. So normally, the major time goes into preparing and characterizing the system. Okay. So introducing a surface into a normal vacuum actually means that you're breaking symmetry and you're imposing boundary conditions that were not there before. And maybe if you're sensitive enough, you'll be able to measure the effect of that. And I wouldn't be saying this if we hadn't done it. And I'd just like to remind you that the vacuum actually had a quite extensive history. If it starts out with a God picture of the void versus the plenum. And then, of course, we all remember the technical vacuum, which actually brought us to the pumps, which nowadays bring us 10 to the minus 13 millibar of pressure. And I'll get back to this technical in a second. Then, of course, with the birth of quantum theory, the physical vacuum not being empty was introduced. And now very accurate or actual, the dark energy and properties of the vacuum that we cannot yet explain. Coming back to the technical vacuum, the old experiment by Guericke, maybe you remember, it's the experiment having two half spheres which were sealed and they could evacuate them. And then they had six horses on one side, six horses on the other side, and when you evacuate the two half spheres, you cannot pull them apart again. Well, that picture actually, this is a stitch. Here's the two half spheres are here, and they're tied up to six horses in this direction, six in that, and Humpty Dumpty couldn't pull them back apart again. Anyways, that picture is actually quite applicable if you want to think about Casimir energy and Casimir process. And so I don't need to repeat that here, but the vacuum is filled with vacuum fluctuations. And they actually, I'll skip this one here. Okay. They exert a pressure if you bring in two plates in the vacuum. So the the quantum electrodynamical picture, I guess, would be, according to Casimir, if you bring two plates into the vacuum, you have two new boundary conditions, which force you to obey the boundary conditions between the plates, but on the other side of the plates, the vacuum is still the vacuum, basically. So what you have up, ending up with many, many vacuum fluctuations on either side of the plates, but only those which have the right wavelength between the plates. That means that the energy density outside the plates is larger than inside the plates, and so you have a gradient of energy. And a gradient of energy is a force, so what happens, just like in the Guericke experiment, you have from the back of these plates the vacuum fluctuations exerting a pressure and pushing the plates together. So that is the quantum picture for two plates, and the same thing can be reformulated for an atom and a plate. An atom, if it has an internal structure, may also act like a mirror, and you get two mirrors, and you get excluded vacuum fluctuations here, and you get more energy outside, so you get a pressure at the back of this atom which pushes it towards the surface. Now, pushing it towards the surface means that it is accelerated, that you sense a little force. And since we have the sensitivity, why not measuring this force? I'll get to this in a second. The question is, well, when is this atom a mirror? And you have to rethink a little bit. This atom is a mirror if it has a transition, an allowed dipole transition, of the order of the wavelength that you want to exclude. And in the case of helium, that means that it's 500 nanometers, so the reduced wavelength of this transition is about 19 nanometers, about 100 nanometers. Angstroms, sorry, 10 nanometers. Now, 10 nanometers is very far away for an atom from the surface. So the force you will feel there is very, very weak. Now, how can you be sensitive so far away from the surface for such weak contributions, to so weak contributions? Okay. It is thinking. I don't know why it's thinking so long. I'm afraid I'll have to stop this. That happened, never happened before. Anybody an idea how to get out of here? Thorsten, you're the Apple expert. It is thinking. But I can't get to the finder. How do you kill it? Ah, okay. Get into the finder, then you can kill it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Did you kill Forshall?
Yeah.
No.
You can kill this also.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. And this one. And yeah, this one. Thank you. And we'll restart it. Where am I? Presentation? No, nothing comes. It should be. view as this presentation. No, view data work. No. So let's run it. I didn't use that. Data, relation selection. Oops. What is it? sorry about this. Okay. No. Item by ZMB first. It must be down here, US something. Captain Blue. Santa Barbara. Okay, sorry about it. Now it's broken. Okay, I'll go ahead. So this is 33. Should it appear again? Okay. Sorry about that. Okay. The quantum picture I gave you before had a surface and an atom. Putting new boundary conditions to the vacuum fluctuations. Another picture, if you like, would be, for example, that of a semi-classical one of an atom with an electron cloud which is fluctuating, and so you get a fluctuating dipole which is sitting in front of a mirror, and you get the induced dipole at the other end, and the fluctuating and the induced dipole interact. And the Casimir part of it is that when this atom is far away from the surface, for the fluctuating dipole information to reach the induced dipole, there's a finite flight time because the information is transmitted at the speed of light. So if the distance is large and it is a noticeably long trajectory, that during this time the fluctuation is actually changing the fluctuating dipole, then the overlap between the fluctuating dipole and the induced dipole is no longer optimal, and you get a reduced interaction out of it. So that's a semi-classical picture, and as a consequence, that would mean that at a certain time scale, in this case, the oscillation time scale of the fluctuating dipole has to be compared to the flight time of the speed of light from here to its image. And it turns out that at distances of, let's say, a nanometer or more, you'll start noticing that it is that the speed of light is actually finite. And so you start getting a reduction of this interaction, which normally is like a van der Waals, 1 over r to the 3, r to the 3rd, and actually is reduced and becomes 1 over r to the 4th. And you can see that in this case for an atom surface, that in fact it's a quantum mechanical effect because the formula contains h bar. It goes with the speed of light, c, and it's a reduction of the interaction from a van der Waals to a Casimir polar by going from a 1 over r to the third to a 1 over r to the fourth. It also contains, of course, the atomic polarizability. Now, that far away from the surface, No, this was just a rough estimate. At that distance, you should start seeing the onset of a different power law. At 300 angstroms, it is totally dominated by the Casimir part, by the 1 over r to the fourth. But even at 30 angstrom, you can see that it's not pure 1 over r to the third. I can show you in a second where the crossover is. I will come to it. Yeah. But it has to do, of course, with the internal frequency of the atoms. And since helium has this ultraviolet transition, it's a very fast oscillation. And so you notice very rapidly that the distance is large compared to the fluctuating dipole. Basically, the hand waving. So the question is, at 30 angstrom or even further away from the surface, the interactions is very weak. How can you still be sensitive to the interaction potential? And then the tool that we invented to use is called quantum reflection. And since you're theoreticians here, I don't really need to introduce it, but since I had such a nice movie, I'd like to run it by you anyway. So the quantum reflection, basically you get at your freshman 101 quantum physics course, a wave packet impinging on a barrier, even if the barrier is lower than the incoming energy of the wave packet, it will lead to partial reflection of the wave from this barrier. This is the over barrier reflection. And actually, as it turns out, it does not depend on the sign of the barrier. If this is an incoming energy, very low, and the barrier is attractive, then you still get, for positive incoming energies, part of your wave packet reflected. Now, I don't know, maybe it's taught here, but not where I grew up. Why that is, nobody ever tells you. They only let you calculate the reflection coefficients in the WKB approximation. You can just match the phases and the things, and then it works out. But why it is, they don't say. Actually, as it turned out, it is the rate of change of the potential with respect to the width of the wave packet, which is important. So if the potential changes on a length scale, which is small with respect to the de Broglie wavelength of the wave packet, then you'll start noticing quantum reflection. Now, since this is quantum reflection, there's no classical analogon. And I was hard-pressed for a popular science talk I was giving to still find something that they could take home and, we guess we know what it is. And so I came up with this little movie. This is the experimentalist's view of quantum reflection. So here's my atom approaching the barrier. And like I said, it's the rate of change of the barrier. So it's a very steep barrier. And my helium atom senses it and figures, oh, what the heck? Part of it reflects. So it's basically height fear of the helium atom, which makes it reflect from the attractive part of the potential. And you can be more quantitative about it. You can define, so to say, Badland functions You can define Badland functions which are defined as the region in my potential where the WKB approximation breaks down. And as soon as that happens, I'll get quantum reflection. And so you write down the rate of change of the potential, you compare it basically to the De Broglie wavelength, and if that becomes of the order of unity, you'll know you get quantum reflection. So, and then you can plot it for the potentials. In this case, I have a Casimir van der Waals potential, and I blow up this region, and I see that for incoming energies of about 10 nanoelectron volts, I get this region where this Badland function becomes 1, and so I should get quantum reflection. So what you do is need now to get a low energy impinging beam, and then I get reflection from the attractive point. Now, how do I get a low energy impinging beam? By using this 1 Kelvin beam that I have, but not going to perpendicular incidence, but go to grazing incidence. The only thing that matters in this picture is the dimension towards the surface. So what I have is this very grazing incidence, and that reduces my incoming energy on 3 orders of magnitude. So I get very low incoming energies, and then I get quantum reflection. The experiment I do then is sit here with my detector, measure how much gets reflected, then change the angle, measure how much gets reflected, and I plot the reflection coefficient as a function of incoming energy, or basically as incoming wave vector. And there is nothing in between there but the potential. So I solve the Schrödinger equation for exactly the potential I have, and then the reflectivity should exactly match my data. Otherwise, I have the wrong potential. Yeah? So this is the kind of experiment I do. So the question was, when does it reflect? Well, when the WKB approximation breaks down, where do I get quantum reflection where the incoming energy and the potential energy are exactly the same? So you know at what point of the potential, from what point of the potential you get the quantum reflectivity, and you match each point, you map it out, and so you get the full potential over its entire energy range where you get quantum reflection. And especially, you get it far away from the surface, where the incoming energy is low, and so you get very sensitive to the transition of a 1 over r to the third to 1 over r to the fourth, going from Casimir to, from Van der Waals to Casimir. Okay. Now, this is, like I said, the experiment. We use the same spin echo machine. We have this incoming energy, we measure the reflectivity as a function of incident angle, and as it turns out, you don't need many angles. It has to still be grazing, so something like 80 degrees is like a perfect incident angle, which means that the De Broglie wavelength is somewhere between a nanometer and a micron. So this one atom has a De Broglie wavelength of a micron. And if we do the spin echo, we can pull them apart 10 microns and bring them back together. And the perpendicular energy then varies somewhere like between a nanoelectron volt and a tenth of a millielectron volt. This is then what you get as a reflectivity. These are the first data we ever got. This is the reflection coefficient on a log scale, and this is the square root of the incident energy. So it's the incident wave vector. And that varies between 0 and 0.25 or something. And you see that the reflectivity drops off 6 to 7 orders of magnitude in that small range. This range is an angle between, it's 6 degrees, between 19 and 84 degrees. So this is 6 degrees in incident angle and 6 orders of magnitude in reflectivity. So it's a very steep energy dependency. No wonder, because basically quantum reflection is nothing else as tunneling. It's the same thing. Yeah, it's the same phenomenon. And it's exponentially dependent on the barrier, like tunneling. The inset. This here. Okay. The In this case, this was the first experiment we did. And we wanted to make sure that we do not see anything else but quantum reflection. Now, like I did in the other experiments, I prepared a surface very well, single crystal, so I get perfect reflection. We call that classical reflection. It's a quantum phenomenon, but still, let's call it normal reflection. The other thing is quantum reflection. Now, what you don't want to do is see a large reflectivity, but it comes from the repulsive wall. So you want to make sure that there's absolutely nothing scattering off of the repulsive wall and then reaches the detector. So in order to make sure that we don't have that, we roughened the surface. So we had this beautiful, flat, singular crystal, and then we sputtered against it and we bombarded it, so it became rough. And we had a handle on how rough it is. We measured how rough it is. And then it was so rough that for normal reflection off of the repulsive wall, it was scattered in all, diffusely scattered in all angular directions, that with our angular resolution, we could suppress it six orders of magnitude. And so it ends up somewhere around here, where you can start noticing normal reflection. And in order to correct for the roughness, we had to correct the data. And that's what we did. That's what you see. So the blue data is what you measure. And then you correct for the roughness to get smooth data, which is the black points. And then we've just put in the potential for helium and quartz, like we got from literature. We solved the Schrödinger equation beyond the WKB, so we exactly solved it. And we plotted the reflectivity you would expect. And what you get is the red curve. So there's no adjustment. That is the potential as it was in literature. And then you get the red curve, which fits the black data. Yeah. Now, that was the first experiment because we wanted to make sure there was no classical reflection, no reflection from the repulsive wall, because we wanted to actually verify a theory by Friedrich in Munich, who said that the quantum reflection should have a certain asymptotic behavior. And in fact, we did that, and that was the inset was all about. But later on, we learned that actually it's a cleverer way of doing this. You don't need to destroy the surface and then hope that you discriminate between repulsive and attractive part by looking at the solid angles. Actually, it turns out that you can measure both of them, and in the data, you will see which one is which, because they have a different shape. We didn't know that, but it turns out that the classical reflection, I'll come back to this picture. So if this is the van der Waals-Casimir attractive part, then we all know that in some kind of Lennard-Jones, you get a minimum, and then it ends up with a steep repulsive wall. And what you could have is that this incoming wave packet actually survives this attractive part, comes all the way to the repulsive wall, and reflects from there. Now, in order to discriminate the classical reflectivity from the quantum reflectivity, it turns out that the shape in the angular distribution is different. One has a Gaussian shape, the other has a Lorentzian. And just by looking at the line shapes and fitting the two simultaneously for the entire data set, you'll get a very conclusive picture of what's happening. And if you do that, for example, for silicon, that's the picture I've shown you just right here. For silicon, actually, this is gold, sorry. If you do that for gold, then you get two contributions. The blue one is the classical repulsive wall reflection, and this is the quantum reflection. Note that the quantum reflection is like two or three orders of magnitude less than the classical reflection because it was single crystal, it was a perfect crystal. And still, you can discriminate between the two due to the line profile. And you can fit the two to give you, for example, a number on the Casimir potential strength. In this case, this was fitted in order to give us a good number on the data, and this is very close to the perfect metal value. And this is very, very, this is head-on to literature. But in this case, it's not very favorable because we have much less quantum reflection than you have classical reflection. So normally, you would like to have it the opposite way. But it turns out that there was no theory for reflection from a repulsive wall at that low energies. And so we had to rethink about that too, and I think we have solved the problem. Yes? Okay. Which one, this one?
Yeah.
That?
No, the one with the...
Okay. So once again, it's the reflectivity on a log scale versus the incoming wave vector perpendicular to the surface. That's the way we included all statistics. Yes. We tried to take everything in.
Plus or minus 1.8 is really a reliable measure of the scatter. The red stuff seems way spread out to me. You've got lots of points within error bars above and below that line. And you've got fairly wide error bars both in. So is it that unique a fit? I mean, is it?
Actually, I think the main contribution to this error is the fact that you can hardly discriminate between the two in this region.
Yeah.
That actually, this initial slope, it's very sensitive to the C4 coefficient. And so we don't get much more statistical accuracy because of the fact that most of it is classically scattered. You see, I mean, that is, you have here, how much is it, two orders of magnitude more classical reflection. And so it's a very tiny contribution, which you need to take out of your data consistently over this entire range. And then that obviously brings you an uncertainty. And I think we've done it correctly.
I don't doubt you did it correctly. I'm just curious if one had alternate models, what would it also be? What seems so scary? I'm not arguing that you did. I'm saying, what other ways would there be that would fit with that one? Is that much better? Not that I can come up with something clever at the moment, but I'm not sure I would immediately draw a parallel of that to our data if you didn't tell me how you got it.
I'll try to convince you in a second that we can do. This is not our best data. Actually, this was data which we never thought had much quantum reflection in it. But in fact, it does. Let me show you then, I think, statistically more. Why there's a difference in shape?
Yeah.
The shape, we don't know why it is different. We just. Actually. It goes together with the fact that this is a power law. The classical reflectivity at very low energy goes as a power law. And it has to do with the fact that you get chaotic behavior at the surface. The surface is not perfectly crystalline. And that chaotic behavior will give you a power law dependency. And it looks like some kind of imperfection. And imperfection always gives you a Lorentzian distribution. Like if you have dirt on the surface, you would get a Lorentzian broadening, because in the it has an exponential correlation length, basically. And that's what comes out in this description here. Well, the other one is Gaussian, because the beam we start off with is Gaussian. And it is not at all deteriorated. It's not at all affected by the reflection, because it's so far away. It hardly sees the surface. So about the question you were asking me, you can define, you can measure this for all kinds of surfaces, metals, insulators, semiconductors, etc. And you can define a transition range where Casimir would go over into van der Waals. And if you describe it by the yellow bars in here, and you plot that for all kind of metals or all kind of surface that we've measured, you can see that for gold, this is the transition range. If the data are left of that, the whole interaction is governed by Casimir interactions. Okay, that makes sense. This is an almost perfect mirror, and so you get large Casimir contributions. If you take quartz, which is a very good dielectric, the data are on the right-hand side, and so the interaction is dominated by the van der Waals tail. And if you have silicon, which is semiconductor, you are right in the middle. And this was early data, and we now have an extended, the best data we have is in silicon. We have extensive data left on right on this transition range, and you can really map out the transition between the two. And I'll try to convince you. Yes, in fact, that was also very good. There is good spectroscopic data in the wavelength range that is of interest to us for silicon and for quartz. And so these are data. These are more or less the best data we have. And you see there's a crossover. Here, at low energies, you have the quantum reflection being dominant, and then the classical reflection starts to dominate at higher energies. And that's exactly what I was trying to say earlier. Now what we did is we took the literature values of the epsilon, put it into the formula, and calculated the interaction potential, and that's the red curve. The quantum reflectivity based on that potential. That's this curve. And we may argue about the statistical error if you wish. But that's it. And here you see, I mean, at the very low energies, you have two orders of magnitude more Gaussian than here. And here you have more Lorentzian reflection. Okay. So, I will skip this and go to some things that we've been specifically addressing with respect to the Casimir force, or in this case, the Casimir folder force, which may be of interest to the members of this workshop, fluctuation-induced interactions. And the first thing we looked at was, well, how does the temperature of the vacuum influence the interaction between the atom and the wall? And when we looked into older publications, it turns out that the predictions were that if you would change the surface about 900 degrees from room temperature up to 1,200 Kelvin, then you would expect only a few percent change. First of all, it's not easy to find a surface which is stable up to those temperatures. So we stuck to silicon, and we measured it, and we found that the quantum reflectivity was actually changing a factor of 10, not a few percent, but up to a factor of 10. And to show you original data, this is the line, the angular profile of the reflected beam. So if you measure the angular distribution of this reflected beam, then this is for the room temperature, and this is for 1200 Kelvin. And you see that in the area, there's a difference, huge difference, up to a factor of 10, which actually means that in the van der Waals, in the Casimir coefficient, force in the strength coefficient, it's up to 170%, something like that. So it's a huge change. And as it turns out, we had to do the analysis. We took again the optical data out of literature for silicon, put them all in. Fortunately, they were given for different temperatures, so we could also take the entire temperature behavior of the dielectric constant of silicon into account, calculated the effect just based upon the difference in conducting electrons, for example. This is very moderately doped silicon, and if you raise temperature, you get more free electrons, and so you get somewhat more ideal metal behavior. If you then calculate how much that would be in the reflectivity, it's only 8%. And we see 170%. So the major contribution must come from something else. And as it turns out, in the Lipschitz formula for the potential as a function of distance r and temperature t, there's a zero frequency term here, which was neglected to have a temperature behavior. And if you do incorporate its temperature behavior, it modifies the potential into this shape. So you get this normal Casimir van der Waals behavior, which is Casimir for it's Casimir for large distances, and it's van der Waals for small distances. But it has this coefficient linear in the temperature, which goes like a van der Waals 1 over r to the third. But it's linear in temperature. And if you fit all the data simultaneously, the 300 and the 1200, with this one potential, then you get a very good agreement with experiment. These are the 300 Kelvin data. These are the 1200 Kelvin data. This is the reflectivity again against perpendicular momentum. And this is one potential describing both curves. And you see the fit is quite good. So we think that's that was evidence for including this zero frequency term temperature behavior in the Lipschitz formula. And okay, there are other issues there. Then one issue we addressed experimentally was looking at the tree of the new boundary condition that you impose onto the vacuum. And we started off with this old issue of a metal sphere, hollow sphere, which was supposed to stabilize the electron as a particle, negatively charged. And we said, well, if you just cut this in half and you make a surface out of it, then you get some kind of focusing of some modes. And if you have the appropriate wavelength of this geometry, then you might focus some interactions and defocus others, and you modify the interaction substantially. And so what we did, we were looking for things that had structures of the order of the nanometer, so nano-crafted surfaces. And we found some commercially available, almost perfect metals. We bought them in gold and in aluminum. You can have a sinusoidal structure. You can have something like a sawtooth structure. And the dimensions of these are, the height and the periodicity are comparable. It's about 300 nanometers, 200 nanometers. The smallest we had was 140 nanometers. Here also the height is about 100 nanometers. The distance here is about 300. So you get the sawtooth structure. And what we decided to do, okay, well, let's have a look at its quantum reflectivity from these structures. And oh, that's not too interesting, I guess. But you see, first of all, you get a much higher reflectivity, much higher than you would get for the same surface, but flat. But you also get dispersion, which is not astonishing. But let's also forget about that, and let's just focus on one of the main results we got from the sawtooth surface. We found that if you take dispersion into account and you do the experiment in three different directions, you fly perpendicular to the steps, parallel to the steps, or diagonally, you get different results. The dependency on the incoming energy is different. And it turns out that, I mean, we have no reason for it, but empirically, we just try to parameterize the effective potential in some kind of form that we used before. Like this would be the normal van der Waals Casimir form, where for large distance, for small distances, you have van der Waals, for large distances, you have Casimir, and the transition is at the length scale L. And now we thought, well, okay, let's look at these different data and tried to get empirical results which describe the data. And it turns out that if you go along the red line, which is 45 degrees, then empirically the data would fit something like a C5. So it's a transition from C5 to C4, from 1 over r to the 4th to 1 over r to the 5th at a length scale L. If you go parallel to the ridges, you get the black data, and you get something like a C5 to C6 transition. And only if you go perpendicularly, you'll find the van der Waals Casimir behavior. Once again, we have no theoretical basis for this these three power laws and this different behavior, but that's what gets out of the data. We just wanted to get a smooth curve through the data, and that's the power law you get. Then we got something more astonishing. It actually makes a difference whether you fly in this direction or you fly in the opposite direction. So whether you hit the ridges first and then slowly go down, or whether you hit the slope and then the ridge. We have no description of that, and everybody here is invited to come up with ideas. If you would just do a very naive analysis based on breaking down of the WKB approximation. So when will you get quantum reflection? When WKB breaks down, that means when you have a bad lat function, which is approximately 1. Then for all these ridges here you're close to the surface, here you're far away from the surface. Here you're close to the surface, far away. So you get this on, off, on, off, on, off, on, off potential. It's a very rapid modulation of the potential. And like I said, the steepness of a potential gives you quantum reflectivity. So you would get much more quantum reflectivity. And if you calculate based upon normal Babband functions, you would get reflection coefficients 1 through the entire energy range. That means that if you just do additive pairwise potentials, you're completely off. It's wrong. It's definitely wrong. So this is another direct proof that dispersion forces are not added. We have been trying to work on this problem to see whether we could at least get an idea of what the potential should be if it's not pairwise additive. And the first thing we did was, well, you can derive the Casimir-Polder result from the Casimir result by taking one plate and thinning it out. You just make the number of atoms less and less and less until you're left with one atom which does not interact with its neighbors. And you calculate the energy in your Casimir-Polder. So we thought, well, that's an ideal way of looking at these ridges. So we have this rigid surface and a flat plate, and we dilute the top plate. Then it immediately turned out that you can no longer use the simplifying math that was applicable doing the two parallel plates. Because now it all of a sudden depends on where this last atom that you end up with sits above the ridges. Does it sit right above a ridge or right above a slope? And so it becomes dependent on its lateral position. And then you can no longer do the simplifying math, because this lateral position turns on in all the expansions that you have there, and they don't drop out. And so it's you cannot solve the problem like that. And then we went to Thorsten's elegant way of describing the interactions in scattering matrices. And this is, for example, a third order process where you have a fluctuation on the, for example, a fluctuation here in the plate. You get a unitary transformation from plate to the ridges, within the ridges to another position, unitary back, and then you close the loop. And you get the green one and the blue one, and you get third order contributions. Now, the advantage of Thorsten's method is that this plate is actually not a plate, but it's an atom. And so you can neglect all higher order, because there's no way that after one loop you'll get back to the same atom again. And so after one loop, you're done, and you can actually calculate the potentials. And Babette, who used to be a diploma student with me, and with Holger Gies, she actually managed to set up the problem and numerically solve it for the ridges. And we have now something that looks like a static potential from which we will try to calculate reflectivity. But that, as such, is also not easy because it is not a static problem. You see, when I have this scattering along a grazing instance, then there's a dynamics involved. I fly in with a horizontal speed which is like three orders of magnitude higher than the transverse one. So I would have to take into account the fact that there's something like a dynamic Casimir effect going on. And in order to make sure that we're doing the right thing, we went back one step to look at the dynamic Casimir effect of this incoming atom and a flat plate. As soon as we have a feeling for what actually the dynamic contributions are, then we know how to invoke them in a more complicated way. So what we did is we took the flat surface and a plate, and we looked at Casimir friction. And in fact, here's again where the spin-echo method came in, because what now happens, you have this atom, let's say, is almost parallel, flying above the surface. And its fluctuating dipole is interacting with its image. But it's moving also in this direction, so it has some drag within the surface. And this drag slows down the atom. And so by slowing it down, you get a small energy loss. Now, the spin-echo method is very sensitive to measuring energy losses. So what we actually measured is, by having this atom flying parallel, almost parallel to the surface, we measured that it actually loses a little bit of energy on the order of 10 to the minus 9 electron volts. Very little, but measurable. And the first results that we got from applying theory that was available in literature is that the numbers seem to match. And so we're trying to nail the thing down now. Yes, I think I should stop here because I've been talking way too long, and we should have a break. And if anybody's interested, we can discuss afterwards and exchange ideas. Let me just thank the people that were involved. Should be right here. So those are former PhD students, diploma students, and my collaborators. With whom we are currently trying to nail down the theoretical issues that we haven't covered yet. This Holger Gies, who now moved to the University of Vienna. Ulrich Jenschura, who used to be at the Max Planck Institution in Heidelberg, now moved to the University of Michigan. And a postdoc from Russia also, a theoretician who remains at the Max Planck Institution. These are the current diploma students working on these and other problems. And I would like to thank you for your attention. No more questions, I guess, huh?